Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it is another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, Mark.
Good to see you once again.
Thank you.
Hey, this week we are launching into a subject. I'm not sure that you've done this particular subject before.
But no, not with the specificity that we're going to get into
when
today.
And we're talking about trusts for your spouse. Now, this isn't how to trust your spouse.
Right, this that's a whole different counselor.
A living trust.
That's right.
Okay.
When I have a couple walk in, one of the very first and primary objectives, even though they don't verbalize it, is that we want to make sure that we take care of each other first. So again, people, when they walk into my office, the presumption is we're going to talk about dying, but they want to skip all the way to the fact that both of them are dead. And we forget that statistically, it is a very, very small probability that you will die in a common accident, mm-hmm. or that you will die very, very close to each other. Now, as you age, as you get into your upper 80s and into your 90s,
that does seem to happen.
Yes, that statistic begins to shrink, actually. And statistically,
or within a couple of months of each other.
Yeah, well, actually, statistically, it's within 2 years of each other. So 18 to 24 months, someone will pass away when a long-term, specifically a first marriage spouse passes away. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, the second spouse dies in very short order. However, if someone passes away younger than what we want, which would be in our 50s, 60s, and even our 70s nowadays, mm-hmm. that appears to be young for dying, there is a probability that a surviving spouse will live for anywhere from 10 to 20 years, specifically if that first spouse dies in their late 50s, early 60s, then we have a 20-year run of needing to make sure that our spouse is going to be well taken care of. And so we need to talk about this gap of when one spouse dies compared to when the other spouse dies. And how do we create a plan? Of course, that's always the presumption that I'm making, is that you're going to make a plan. And how does the plan operate, and what do we need to have in place to best protect a surviving spouse when one of us passes away? So,
is the surviving spouse usually the wife?
Yeah, yeah. A majority of the time, it is the surviving wife that passes away second. So that means men, we get to go first. As a matter of fact, in all my stories, if you've listened to my radio program for any length of time, I always have the man die first. Well, why? That's not just to be nice. It's actually because statistically men are going to live a shorter lifespan. Of course, that's not always the case. But anything that we talk about, it doesn't matter who dies first. The question is, how do we protect each other? It is one of our greatest goals as spouses is, how do I make sure that my spouse is going to be well taken care of, that we don't spend unnecessary tax money? I don't know anyone yet who just says, yeah, I don't care if we overspend on taxes. Now, if there is a higher goal, such as we have a disabled child, well, we may need to prioritize that in place of taxes. Or in this case, how can we develop a plan that protects a surviving spouse and yet is also tax conscientious, not overly tax driven, but tax conscientious? And so there are things that we do in estate planning to ensure that a surviving spouse is well taken care of and that the client's objectives are actually met. Now, let me talk about that real quick. Most of the time, a client's objectives, when they are talking about, if I were to die first, how do I want to take care of my spouse? A client's objectives usually revolve around one of two things, or actually kind of two things combined. I gave one of them away already, which is, I don't want this to be tax inefficient. But yet, I want to leave as much power and control as I possibly am able to my surviving spouse. So if we did not use a trust and we simply had a joint checking account, okay, and we had a joint house together, let's say those are the only two, let's make it super simple. Those are the only two assets in my storyline right now. It is a it's a natural presumption that if I were to die, my wife, Mariana, would then take over my house and have full control of it. And actually, by law, that's what would happen as well. Even absent any type of estate plan, that's what would take place, is that my wife would then have full control of the house and full control of the checking account. Now, there are some lack of controls, such as she would be required to pay any hospital bills or pay any credit card bills or anything else that was attached to my name. So there's always a structure that we have to go through when someone dies. However, regardless of that, the natural presumption is that my wife would be left with everything at her fingertips and would be in full control of that. So here's the thing that we need to have a balance with when we want to structure things for tax efficiency, or have that as a goal, not the primary goal, but at least one of the goals would be tax efficiency, then there's always one of three things that we must give up. So we either need to give up power, okay, so that power and control we have to give up. We have to give up that it can benefit from us, or that we can benefit from the asset. So that would be a delusion. Or number three is we have to give up tax savings. So all three of those cannot exist simultaneously. I cannot have power and control. I cannot have the asset benefit me. And I cannot have taxes. All three cannot work simultaneously together. One of those must be compromised in order for taxing to work. Okay, so typically if we want to give up taxing, we want tax efficiency, then we have to dilute or give up some sense of control or some sense of benefit. However, if we want to keep full control and full benefit, then the taxing structure wanes. So in other words, all three of those cannot be accomplished simultaneously. One of them must be in a submissive place. All right. So when we are talking about how do we best leave assets to a surviving spouse, the question is, how much control do we need to have over the asset when one spouse dies versus how much benefit do we want the surviving spouse to have versus how much taxes do we want to mitigate and manage should I die? So again, all three of those cannot be at 100%. Something must give way. Mm. And so really, the objective then is finding out where is that happy balance as far as mitigating taxes, but yet leaving a spouse in control so that they can fully benefit. And one of these three must suffer or be diluted to accomplish any type of estate plan. And by the way, an estate plan absolutely works like this. You may not know it. If we use a will or if we use joint assets, there is no tax planning. So what you're doing is you're giving full control and full benefit to a surviving spouse, but you have forfeited all tax structuring. So in order to have tax structuring, then we need to...
You need to have a trust.
We need to minorly dilute. Yes, number one, we need a trust. And so the question is, what does a trust do and how does it benefit? And how does that functionality work? Well, number one, this is a big issue of counseling. You have to sit down with the right estate planner. I don't care if it's me or not me. All I need is for my audience to get the fire under them to actually go and talk with someone that they will trust so that they can develop an estate plan that will best benefit themselves and their spouse number one, themselves during their lifetime. Number two, their spouse if they should die. And then number three, kids or ministries or nieces and nephews. I don't care who is going to take the rest of everything. There needs to be a structure in place. So we have to have an estate plan as a starting foundation to anything that we're talking about. If you just let the law happen, then actually you may give up control, you may give up taxes, and you may give up benefit, and you just don't even know it. So we need to have your voice talking to these three major issues. Number one, control. Number two, benefit. And number three, taxes. They can work simultaneously together. They can cooperate together with a good plan. But like I said, the first step is we have to have a plan. Then number two is that you have to sit down with somebody that you trust who will guide you through the process of actually designing a plan so that it meets your expectations and your desires with those three categories. So if you don't find the right person to sit down with, and no, I don't think you can do things like this online. So yes, you can get a cheap plan online. Why is it cheap? Because you have no counseling and there's no planning that is going to raise to the level of actually sitting down with someone to create something that is going to function as you really need it. So what happens if your spouse has never managed money in his or her lifetime, and you are the one who manages it all? Will the surviving spouse actually be able to manage that for the first time in his or her life during the grieving process and at the moment when you pass away? Most of the time that I see, the answer is no. And so if you have been the one in control of all the finances, and notice how it, I said him or her, because I know wives who manage all the finances. I know husbands who manage all the finances. It doesn't matter. The question is, if your plan does not accommodate that my spouse has never managed the finances, they've never had a talk with the CPA, they don't know the first thing about taxes, they've never talked to the financial advisor, they don't pay the bills, they don't even know how to get online to pay the bills or to manage their money, then we already have a problem at hand that we need good planning for. Not that we can't give control or teach the surviving spouse what to do, but we're already at a place to where we need to sit down and make a strong plan of attack, and that's what good planning should do. So good planning should talk about control, it should talk about benefit, and it should talk about taxes all together. And there are solutions to make sure that your spouse can be well taken care of in a place where they may not have all the knowledge that you do, or you don't want to overspend on unnecessary taxes. Well, we've got solutions.
He's got solutions. Paul Grant and Planning with Purpose, his office. And if people are interested and they want to know more about your services, how do they get in touch with you, Paul?
Well, head over to legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts. There's upcoming educational workshops, a great place to start the whole journey. And there's ways to communicate with us. So head over to legacyandfaith.com.
Back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. I will be presenting a half-day session on faith and finances, irresistible generosity. In this session, I will walk us through what it looks like to apply our faith over our finances in a biblical manner so that we can accomplish kingdom purposes. We all deal with finances in one way or another, so let's find out how this journey of faith applies to our money. Faith and Finances will be presented on Saturday, July 16th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., graciously hosted by Venture Church in Mill Creek. There's no cost to attend, so join me on Saturday, July 16th for Faith and Finances, Irresistible Generosity. You can find more information at legacyandfaith.com and sign up for this Faith and Finances opportunity.
Many families realize that with the passing of each generation, their family legacy is disappearing and they're feeling regret. To alleviate this heartache, Memories Worth Telling writes their family story and creates a beautiful heirloom book to preserve their unique history. Go to memorieswordtelling.com to schedule your initial consultation and learn how they can capture your legacy. Once again, that's memorieswordtelling.com. Photos.com.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant this week, looking at creating a trust for the surviving spouse. And you talk a lot about revocable living trusts. Is that the kind of trust we're talking about here?
Yeah, a revocable living trust is kind of the foundational instrument that we use in estate planning. You can use a will, but like I said, there's really no ability for me to do tax planning within a simple will. So therefore, a majority of my clients utilize a trust. And it's because we have the greater flexibility to manage these three compartments, the control, the availability of assets to take care of a surviving spouse, and we can start doing tax mitigation. So in a revocable living trust, almost every trust that I've ever seen, now almost, that is not absolute. As a matter of fact, I just had one roll across my desk where this couple have a taxable estate, and yet it didn't assist with any of the tax structure whatsoever. So it was a colossal failure, which is unfortunate because they entrusted an attorney to assist them through that process, but yet we missed the basic reason for using a trust. So how most trusts actually work is that when one spouse dies, then half of the property – so let me be more specific – half of the community property and any individual property that the first spouse to die has will go to a trust called a family trust in my system. Now, this trust is known as a safe harbor trust, an AB trust. I call it a family trust. I don't care what fancy name an attorney puts on it. It's all the same. And so it doesn't matter what you hear in the marketplace. It doesn't matter what you read online. Almost every standard trust works like this, to where the community property portion and individual property of the decedent moves to a trust that is formed specifically for, on the decedent's behalf, but for the benefit of the surviving spouse and or the family. Now, why does this happen? There's two major reasons. One is protection, one is tax planning. And notice how I said that only half of the community property. So because we live in Washington and we're a community property estate, then if I were to die, everything my wife and I have built, I have the ability to use my voice to say, I want my portion when I die to be managed and handled like this. So in a traditional trust, what happens is that my voice says, I want my portion to be put inside of a trust that I've created when I die, though, not before that, only after I die. And that trust is going to benefit my spouse. So as a matter of fact, we kind of call them I love you trusts, which is, honey, I love you so much. You can go ahead and use whatever I have set aside for you virtually, not completely, but virtually in any way that you desire. As a matter of fact, the IRS tells us how to develop this trust, because one of the primary objectives is that we want to start having tax mitigation within the plan that we create. So therefore, we create a trust that is going to start that process. Okay, but remember, at the beginning of the show, I said we can only accomplish two out of the three. We can never accomplish all three objectives. All three objectives are full control, full benefit, and full tax mitigation. So something has to give. So if we start a trust that assists in tax mitigation, then that means either full access or full control must begin to wane. Now, the IRS tells us how to do this so that we can align with their rules. Because if we're going to get a tax benefit, then that means we have to begin to shape the plan according to what the IRS tells us to do, right? Mm-hmm. They're the taxing structure, and or Washington State is the taxing structure, because in Washington, we have an estate tax. We also have an estate tax on the federal level. Washington is a little over, just under $2.2 million, but that's an easy number for everyone to remember. So it's $2.2 million. If you have more than that, it is, you absolutely need to use a revocable living trust. The federal level is a little over $12 million right now, and each of those numbers are per person. So if you're married, you can protect up to $4.4 million or up to $24 million on a federal level. But the reason that we split the trust in two is to begin taking advantage of what we call those exemptions. In other words, that money that we can save, we want to take advantage of it. So as we start this whole process, a trust is split into two. So we start with one trust, and both spouses manage it and have full power and control. And together, they have to make adjustments in it. Okay, when one spouse dies, the community property of the one who dies first, so I'm going to use myself, I die, my portion of it goes to a trust, my wife keeps full control of her portion. Now, I ask clients all the time, have I taken anything from you? And intuitively they say, no, you haven't taken anything away. Correct, I haven't. Okay, what I've done is we've just split it for tax savings clauses. But again, my trust says, Mariana, come and use as much as you want. So I haven't taken anything from the surviving spouse. We build a bridge between the two trusts, and my wife can use her portion of the estate that she has full control over. She can still disinherit our two daughters. She can give it to charities. She can give that portion to a new spouse. She can do anything she wants. Okay, but my portion now, the rules have become what we call irrevocable, because I can't sign a piece of paper anymore. Those rules now cannot change because we can't get my signature. So therefore, the rules are set up in my trust to say, Mariana, please use my money whenever you need. Okay, but now we've started tax mitigation. And by the way, if my wife was ever in a car accident, okay, it was her fault. She ran into somebody. How much money could be taken? Mark, I'll let you play my audience, okay? So my wife in the storyline has her portion of her money that she's in full control of, and then my portion is set aside for the benefit of my spouse. My wife, after I die, rams into somebody, clearly her fault. She's getting sued. How much money? Can it be her side only, my side only, or both of our sides? So how much can they come after?
I would say if it's in a trust, they can't come after any of it.
Okay. So great response. So because my wife still has full control of her portion, they can come after her.
Okay.
And that portion of it. But because I didn't cause that accident, remember, my side's irrevocable.
Oh, I see.
Now they cannot come after my side. So there's issue number two, is that I've set up protecting my spouse with at least half of our assets.
Okay.
So that now we have tax mitigation, and now we have started a protection mitigation against my wife's creditors. Or if she were to ever get remarried, she says that I have been so hard to train that she would never get married again. But that's a whole nother story that for another day. And so if she ever got remarried, then my portion is set aside for the girls, so that, because that's where I would want my assets to go should she not need to use them. So now we're starting to add in protections and tax mitigation, and most trusts will accomplish this minimum goal, that it splits into two and we begin the tax mitigation. The problem is that all of this doesn't happen by osmosis. When someone dies, we need to get back to the attorney so that we can actually begin to implement the plan as it was designed. So there's a lot of great planning out there that people never actually bring back to the table when one spouse dies, and then we're trying to sort it out years down the road, or even worse, when the surviving spouse actually dies, then the kids come marching in. Well, they had this trust, and now I'm looking for that family trust. That's the first spouse to die's trust, and I can't find it. Well, that means we didn't take advantage of the tax or the protections because it was never practically utilized. So all great planning is only as good as how it's administered. And that's why in our system, we keep people close and have a relationship with them because we understand that a lot of these places where, such as one spouse dies, a lot of surviving spouses are grieving. And if they don't have a relationship, they won't administer it. They won't start closing it. And now the plan didn't work as designed.
Okay, how to create that trust for the surviving spouse, very important, a specific discussion this week. I think we're going to continue this next time. People are intrigued, though. They want to find out more about your services. Paul, how do they do that?
Head over to my website, legacyandfaith.com, past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate with us, legacyandfaith.com.
Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Great stuff every time.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.